Hello and welcome to the Newism podcast, where we talk to social entrepreneurs and big thinkers to discover how they would shape a new, more sustainable and inclusive global system where humans live within the means of the planet and all forms of life can thrive. Our guest this week is Tamsin Ratcliffe, a serial social entrepreneur who has worked across the public, private and civil society sectors to drive greater impact in the application of capitals to social and sustainable development. She is the director of the Impact Trust, an organisation committed to promoting the skills that contribute to global citizenship, sustainability intelligence, and leadership action. Her latest initiative is Roots to Resilience, which equips young people and professionals to become the sustainable, resilient leaders of the future. At the heart of Mel and Tamsin's conversation is whether we can harness what we have learned during the current coronavirus pandemic to build a better future for all. They discuss how COVID-19 and the climate crisis are interlinked, the skills we need to navigate this new future, and how the way business reacts to the crisis will have a major impact on how we progress as a society. Both Tamsin and Mel have thought a lot about the long-term impact of the pandemic and the opportunities and risks, so this is a really interesting listen. The current series of the Newism podcast was recorded during lockdown, so we were at the mercy of technology and Wi-Fi connections. Please bear with us if the sound quality isn't quite up to scratch. We promise the content of the conversations is worth it.
For this edition of the Newism podcast, really pleased to welcome Tamsin Ratcliffe from Impact Trust, a well-known social entrepreneur who's done tremendous work over the years. So just talking about before we started this, that your son's just finished his exams in the middle of this pandemic. Some celebrations in your household at the moment, Tamsin?
Absolutely. I think it's obviously a marking point, even though it has felt slightly fizzled down at the end. But it nevertheless is a transition and it's a passage. And, you know, so yes, there's cake and chocolate.
Well, why not? It deserved. Absolutely. So really pleased that you could come in and talk about Newism. Obviously, we've been doing this well before the pandemic hit. And obviously, people are talking about, okay, well, there's going to be this downturn and then we'll just go back to normal. Other people are talking about, you know what, there's an opportunity for a new normal, and maybe what does a new normal look like? And obviously, this fits perfectly into the work you're doing, getting us to think about the impact that's going on and what potentially might the world look like if we were to take a different course of action. So very interested to hear your views on that and what you think the opportunities might be for us at this moment.
So, I think, firstly, I feel slightly, despite my background, which actually was in finance and then in social development, so I feel like I've walked both sides of the line of what might be seen as more capitalism and socialism divides. I think there's a challenge for me about isms in general, because I think that they really create an authoritative dialogic as opposed to a discussive or discursive one, and they become so absolute, and you know, pessimism and optimism are seen as so absolute. And I would say that I'm generally an optimist, but there are sometimes I'm so pessimistic. So how do you balance those two, and how do we create a system that actually is more relational, more contextual? Somebody who I've been reading quite a lot of, and I don't know if you know, is Neil Vahl, and he was at Gaia Education and has really been looking at regenerative practice. And I think it's very interesting to see some of his readings about how he believes isms often stop us from actually really experiencing and being present in the different context. And I suppose the one most really enriching talk that I went to once was interestingly, in 2008, which was equally a year, a little bit like this one, of the best of times and the worst of times. I mean, for social enterprise, 2008, you know, it was the first Social Enterprise World Forum, and there was this big movement starting. And in fact, it was at the first Social Enterprise World Forum, which was in Edinburgh, that Charlie Leadbetter did the opening talk. And he spoke about having more of a with economy, and described that as really often what governments need to do is do things to you or for you, but in trying to be objective and not preferring or showing favor, they often are not with you. And that he was talking about having this with economy, which was much more of a community, relational, lifeblood, engaging one. And that has always struck me quite strongly. And, you know, when I first started in social development with greater capital and greater good, one of the things we tried to do in South Africa was talk about social profit organizations, because again, the duality and the separation or the schism of non-profit and for-profit actually can sometimes allow non-profits to feel holier than thou. We work at lower rates of pay, we do things for the greater good, and therefore you should support us. And actually there can often be a lack of accountability. So really what we try to talk about in the not-for-profit sector, in the development sector, was what is your social profit? What are you accountable for that means you deserve the marginal dollar or the marginal pound in terms of your return? Because there has to be a return. And so that language of capitalism, the notion of a return, I think is something that I suppose it's transcendent of the ism. And it's about reciprocity. So, you know, we've got to think of a bad word as what's the return on investment, but actually what is the reciprocity? And I think that sustainable giving often is when you know that what you're doing is effective. And that means that you have an idea of the impact. You don't have to be acknowledged even, but reciprocity just comes in that sense of knowing. So, you know, when we started Greater Good, sorry, I think, I don't know if I'm rambling. Or
no, you're not rambling. This is absolutely fascinating. Maybe I could just cut you off there slightly. Because, I mean, we've set this up as this new ism. It doesn't necessarily mean there's an ism in the way you're describing it. It's like it's a new way. What I think we're saying is that actually we don't have the answer here around this new ism. But we need to hear voices such as yourself to describe maybe what it might look like, and then maybe it changes a name. But we want to get voices from practitioners and people who've been out there. So what you're describing actually is absolutely fascinating and can be one of the kind of key values of what we're trying to create going forward. So this whole business of, as you're describing there, a not-for-profit and holier-than-thou and the profit, feeling superior because they say, well, we're self-sustaining, so we're making money, so we're superior to you kind of thing. Or I've often heard them say, well, we're responsible for shareholders and you're responsible for nobody. That type of dialogue, which I'm sure you've heard. Moving away from that, as you say, to say, look, there's different entities and kind of what's the impact of what we're doing and how do we work together, understand each other and so on. So totally with you. So please go on in the theme. I almost kind of think towards the practical, from what you're describing then, and I was at that World Forum, that first World Forum in Edinburgh, by the way. I heard Charlie of it, so we were sitting in the same room. And that was a great start with something. So practically, though, how do we move forward to start that happening? Because we're some way off what you're describing.
I think we are a long way off, and I read the instruction not to be negative.
No, well, you can be. That's right. In this podcast, we want to be constructive. But in some ways, to be constructive, you have to talk about the negative to get on to the positive.
I mean, I think interestingly, so my background is not only finance, it's also psychology. And you know, the one thing that I think at the Skoll World Forum in Oxford a couple of years ago, they had that TEDx on truth. And one of the things that it was asking you is, what is your truth? And I suppose for me, my truth has been hope. And yet in psychology, hope is often, in a hopeless situation, hope is often seen as expended energy, not well put. But I think that a lot of people who are still working now for social development and are still trying to hold that hope and are really trying to motivate around it. And I suppose that what we might have at the moment is the strongest schism between sides. And maybe that is what this point is. It is almost like a breaking point. And I think we've grown up to it or built up to it over the last couple of years, as we've seen people like Trump and, you know, all the kind of great divide of nationalism, populism, if you like. Yeah, and populism. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and whether it's having to go through that so that we can come out another side, and whether COVID is the moment, you know, I have been disconcerted by a lot of people saying, I just hope, you know, we've got to get the economy back again. And I know there's the build back better, but there's not yet a build different. And yet I think it's going to be inevitable. I think there has been a real challenge on people's perception of their own vulnerability, their own responsibility for their self-reliance, actually, which for the reliance, and that self-reliance includes your neighbor right next to you, who you need to know and look after. So it might be that this is, you know, the great hand of God in some way. I mean, you know.
I know what you mean. It's a kind of, a very difficult negative situation, actually opportunities emerge, clarity emerges, actually, surprisingly, of a way forward. But there are so many voices, as you say, that are, and then this is maybe negative, around saying, oh no, it's okay, it's just going to be a difficult patch, and then we'll be all back on the overcrowded trains, and you know, we'll all back on having 0 hours contracts, etc. But that seems to be the kind of mantra that's been getting out. And unless we get back onto that, then we're all doomed, as it were. But I do think that, you know, I kind of agree with you, there's potential here. But we have to make sure that voice of real change is heard, I think.
I think you interviewed previously John Elkington, actually, and I had listened to that. And he's, of course, just written the book Green Swans, which, you know, and he is somebody who, interestingly enough, when I started my career in finance, triple bottom line was the big thing, which, of course, he subsequently recalled, as it were. But in Green Swans, what he talks about really is resilience and about these changes. And I think what frustrates me a little bit in the world today is they haven't equated, everybody's talking about the COVID crisis and then there's the climate emergency, as though these are distinct and separate things. And I think, you know, for me, in trying to speak to what he talks about, his three R's at the moment, which are very similar to ours, are responsibility, resilience, and regeneration. And that actually, yes, there are some things that will continue that have a link to the old order, but actually regeneration and renewal has to involve a different way of doing things. And I think Alex and I were talking previously about imaginal cells. And I didn't know exactly. Imaginal cells are in a caterpillar, and they are the prototype cells that become the butterfly, but they are seen by a caterpillar as foreign. And what happens when a caterpillar goes into a cocoon? Its immune system mounts a fight against the imaginal cells of the butterfly, and it is only by withstanding that battle and continually persevering with the imagine of the butterfly that a butterfly can evolve. And if the if too long the caterpillar goes on, it can destroy those imaginal cells and you will end up with a never evolving caterpillar and a dead pupa, as it were. And it's an incredible metaphor, because I think John had written this book, so I asked him this question the other day, is, would we not see COVID as this moment of the war, if you like, between the imaginal cells and the outdated world of the caterpillar, and how do you get through that? So
there's potential for us to emerge into this beautiful butterfly on the one hand, but also kill ourselves on the other. It's a new kind of thing.
Absolutely. You know.
And so to emerge into the beautiful butterfly, there are people around such as yourselves, as other social entrepreneurs, as emergence of new networks like Catalyst 2030, which are trying to pool together social entrepreneurs with funders to create system change. Is that the right journey that people should be on at the moment? Where should we be? Because it's, in some senses, yep, we want to be this butterfly, but the bigger challenge for people is, how do we become the butterfly? What is it that makes it, that makes us into that butterfly? And what do we have to get rid of to move forward? Is it all just about climate change, or is it about systems of government? Is it about our systems of finance? And is it a complete change of everything that's required?
I think what's interesting is that it has never been clearer that it is all sectors of society, or the economy, society, government. Because under climate change, we've often heard governments will never make the decision. It's business who has to, you know, of the biggest 100 entities in the world, more than 50% are businesses, not governments. So in the whole climate debate, there's been this discussion, business has to get on board. Now we're looking under COVID, and never before has government got so engaged in terms of actually recreating or doing structures that would have been thought of before as impossible. But equally, civil society has, you know, and I've seen a lot more of this in South Africa than here, where actually over communities that were typically divided, the obviousness of your wealth, and this is relative to your poverty in it. So I'm not talking about wealth as in West Kensington elite homes versus Grenfell Tower. I'm talking about the average middle class home and a township shack. That disparity is now the difference between survival and transmission. And making it. And so you've seen incredible social engagement across all of those divides. And so I do believe that you're actually going to have to get all three sectors here. You know, I think, and I think it's right, because I think climate change equally will not be achieved if not everybody is together. There are too many loopholes in I suppose the allowances and subsidies.
So there's a kind of what you're talking about there is a kind of convergence at the neighborhood level, if you like, kind of people understanding it's not about the size of the house or the gate around the fence they've only got their garden, etc., etc. It's about human beings, and it's about our local communities, etc. But also isn't it about kind of questioning the structures of organizations? So I had a very interesting talk yesterday from a leading business in India, which successful tech business, which you probably class as a good business, because you know prior to COVID-19 they were good employers. They had very good CSR policies. They had developed a foundation. They were doing things for people, women in particular, living in poverty in India. And so the guy was kind of saying, well, of course, this is kind of in the DNA of the company, but hey, what do I do here? Our order book's going to go down. And what's my role? Is my role as an employer so that, you know, I could actually... some people know I could make redundant, and they would lose the jobs, and I could save some money, and I could use that money to to put into a very poor community in India as a kind of donation. But actually, shouldn't I be keeping the people on because that would have a greater impact? And so he was challenged, and he was being very open about this challenge for them as a company in terms of what's our role in society. It's about employment and as opposed to being a good citizen company. And I think it was a very honest rhetorical question he was asking to create a debate, and it was really around what's our role here? What's the role of a business? And that's a very fundamental question. And he was kind of leaving aside, you know, what the shareholder ownership structure was or whatever. And I think that that's the sort of area that we need to kind of look at. And we need people who run successful businesses to be asking that question. And then for us to be understanding about what a role of business might be in the wider community. So potentially in that you have change. And to your point there about, you know, the middle class brick house as opposed to somebody living in a township.
So, I mean, interestingly, of course, I do think what has changed dramatically is the belief business of business is business, you know, and I think that even as at the WEF this year, I suppose, when we started talking about stakeholder primacy, no longer shareholder primacy. So I think that is an awareness that has been growing, maybe not fast enough and maybe not wholeheartedly enough in terms of intrinsic integrity, if you like. But I think one thing that COVID has also taught is globalization, and globalization of supply chains is highly problematic. And if you're not looking after a more local area, you know, things like transmission, plane flights, the spread of things in terms of not being locally active and community driven. So I think that is going to be something that is going to dramatically change. I'd be interested in what it means for cities coming out of this, because I think that is something else that, you know, even though we predict by 2050, 80% of people will be living in cities, actually, I think COVID has demonstrated what is wrong with cities. And equally, business efficiency has demonstrated what is wrong in terms of resilience of the business and its people, you know. So I agree with you. I think what is the business of business? And more importantly, it is how do we do the business of business? And I, you know, for me, I think a lot, you know, I think of Simon Sinek and of course, why and purpose, and everybody's really about purpose. You know, purpose is the new strategy. I think we can all understand purpose. I think a lot of CSR programs understand purpose, but I think how do you live that? And so I suppose the work that we've been trying to do has been trying to develop what are those behavioral skills and what is that behavioral intelligence, if you like. And I, you know, we've been battling with a word to describe it, but, you know, when we started, we wanted to try and look at how to change within education systems, which is incredibly difficult. So we started going directly to youth and really working with youth to change mindsets. And it is about a resilience mindset, and a resilience mindset is more relational, is more agile, is more respectful of diversity, is more adaptable. It has the agility, if you like, and the buffering that can weather change. You know, hope is a resilience factor, I have to say, you know. So in terms of my work right now, one of the things I am looking at is how can business start looking at repositioning staff by understanding their mindset and their adaptability and their agility, if you like, and where they can be best positioned, because I think there are massive retrenchments coming, and how business does that is going to have a major impact on how we progress as a general society. I was very intrigued to hear of a retrenchment program at one of the big banks where what they did was they worked, with a coach with staff who were being retrenched, and they identified their skill set and particularly the nonprofit that they were most interested in supporting. And they then paid their salary over a year to work with that nonprofit and to really build, if you like, a position for themselves, either with that organization or moving forward. So it was, how do you sort of blend this value of business? And for me, that's an incredible CSR related work program, you know. So I think I suppose it's the 100 monkey story, you know. How do you get this viral transmission of the new ism in behavior? You know, maybe it's behaviorism, I don't know, but you know.
it's so interesting, because I think any time I've kind of spoken to leading business people in the world, well, you can inform or wherever, and said, anybody think homelessness is a good idea? Well, nobody does, okay? But you know, my next question is kind of why do we have it then? I mean, we've created this system, and I generally find that human beings are good people. So the people who run these companies aren't bad people; they're good people. It's the system, and it's almost like they kind of have these discussions, and then they'll go back to the day job, as it were, back to the desk, and then it's all about kind of how do we increase shareholder value, etc. And it's how do we move away from that? So some of these things have been happening, right? So we're talking about stakeholder capitalism now, or compassionate capitalism, or whatever. But it really just need to move on further in a practical way too. And one of the kind of levers in this that I think starts to emerge is, of course, government. And now, If you'd said to people, if you and I had said, you know, 3 months ago, that governments of the world are going to come up with billions that they're going to pay out to protect the private sector, you'd have said we'd gone mad. Mm. But here they are. But I think one of the things that's, and credit to them potentially, because they're obviously trying to protect the system and people at the end of the day. But I think they missed a trick. Because they're giving all these loans and grants and so on and so forth, and they could have put conditions on them. And they could have been saying things like, I'll tell you what, and simple conditions, not heavy conditions, along the lines of, okay, well, you're going to have to, as part of this, you stop using fossil fuels, only use clean energy, it's part of the deal. You've got to have half your staff have to cycle to work. I'm making this up, okay? But I'm trying to illustrate there that actually, governments now have an increasing role in potentially directing where we go. We're moving away from potentially kind of really liberal private sector activities into something that's a bit more controlled, and therefore governments have more control on what our ethical positions might be in the future. Mm. Do you think that's right, or are governments simply going to be push back into the margins again in the future?
Well, you know, I agree with you, actually. I think that I do think governments, there's an emergent process where I think conditionality is starting to emerge. I think even with the extension of the furlough here in the UK, it has been with some conditionality starting to show. And will governments be bold enough and brave enough and the problem is coherent enough actually between themselves as well? Because that has been, I think, one of the single biggest downfalls, is that there's always a way you can become a non-dom somewhere else and sort of loop the system. So, you know, if we need globalization, it might well be of the social policy or of government policy or you know. But I agree with you. I do think there's a unique moment for governments to take. I worry, though, having read about, I don't know if you know about the toxic triangle, right, where they talk about vested self-interest, political will, and benefits. And I guess problem with governments often is the short-termism, is, you know, that actually it often doesn't allow for the same expansive vision that a Unilever looking at 30 years time does, because actually the moment is 3 years. I think that's one of the difficult the biggest difficulties. And then, of course, vested interests. I mean, we all know about the fossil fuel vested interests and power behind governments, whether that is changing through, I suppose, if you like, the uprising of many. And I, you know, and just the obviousness that is becoming apparent to everybody. But it's equally, there's a, it's how do you negotiate? And I'm afraid I'm an all or nothing person. So for me to appreciate that there's a nuance in, you know, how do we can't just stop cars tomorrow. What would that do? Or oil and gas. And you know, how do we do that weaning process is a, I don't know that how. I'm, you know, just cold turkey. Have we got enough in place? But I think it's going to happen.
I think for me, obviously we talk about how this newism moves going forward, and I do think in a smaller world, a more globalized world, the institution, the global institutions such as the United Nations, the IMF, the World Bank, etc. I wonder if they're, which came out the Bretton Woods. I mean, are they fit for purpose in a modern world? In our newism going forward, are we looking at new global institutions that, A, to your point, can look at the situations long term, so that you can talk about the reduction of fossil fuels and what that means for that industry and those workers associated with that industry, and then the growth of green energy on the other side. Is that the sort of role that they have, taking on a longer term views by, you know, having a protection, the word protection of the planet? Some sort of role there, because lots of people will talk about the problems, you know, you call it the toxic triangle of politics or short-termism, but what the question always is, right, what do you replace it with? And if you had, maybe you have better conditionality on the private sector at the minute, if you had governments with a longer-term view, because they could say, right, this is where we're going, in the long term, and we have a plan of how we're going to get there. So it's, to me, it's like, okay, well, we don't have the global institutions that currently work, so we have to change them.
Absolutely. I don't know whether this is too muesli and sandals an idea, but one of the things that we've learned under lockdown is actually being able to read a book, do your gardening, plant your vegetables, clean your own house, take your children for a walk, you know, the balance of life. Well, certainly, I don't know if it's only me, but I feel that it's been, I've made more home-cooked meals, I've baked bread, it's, you know, planted vegetables with my son, he's repainted the room, and you know, Finland, I think, has this. Is there a different way of working? Is there maybe a way that business has to build in less efficiency, if you like, and not go for this productivity at the expense of people having enough work and enough lifetime? And you know, is this actually a moment of balancing those things? And, you know, if it became mandatory that people couldn't work more than 20 hours a week, well, maybe the salary for one person who's working 7-hour weeks and every hour God made actually gets balanced between people working half weeks, or, you know, it could be very idealistic, and I know that. And
but we have to be idealistic in some way, don't we? If we're we have to have a vision, don't we, of what the world might look like ideally, and then try and move towards that vision. So maybe what you're describing is the issue about how much we work and where we work.
And being seasonal, going to bed with the sun, and, you know, or waking up with the sun, and it's like,
But the question is, I mean, it's interesting because I've heard a number of people kind of say now that they've got out of the shock of the having to stay at home, actually, you know, there's some benefits to it. And actually, now, you know, we're speaking on Zoom here. I'm very used to Zoom meetings, and actually, I'm thinking actually they're more efficient than the face-to-face meetings I'm used to having. So maybe this is going to be the way of it. But the question would be, how quick do we kind of forget about all this and kind of go, oh, remember that time? It's a bit like our New Year's resolutions. We have the New Year's resolution for a while, and then they kind of, a lot of the times they disappear. So are we going to, is this really a new way we are going to work and appreciate the home baking and so on that you're talking about, the way we're working, or is this just kind of an experience we're going to tell our grandchildren of the future?
Well, you know, I mean, it's one of the interesting things. Paradigms usually go in lifetimes, if you like, and actually, relatively speaking, both capitalism and communism are very young. And it could well be that they are old enough that the generation that manifests them is now the ending generation, and there's this little bit of hybrid. And I know it's one of the things that I think mentioned in the book is, actually, it might well be that there are these seismic shifts. You know, astrologically, they often look at these different cycles. So I believe that this situation, particularly the COVID crisis, and the timing of it so perfectly with this 2020 and this moment that actually everybody has said, in a climate perspective, has to be the moment of the turning point. I mean, it's not lost on me that these things have converged at the same moment. And so it could well be. I mean, there's that story about this man who he's in a village and the village is flooding, and the government comes on the radio and says, you've got to all leave the villages. Says, I'm going to wait for a sign from God, and the army comes through and gets everybody out. And he says, no, I'm staying here. I'm going to wait for a sign from God, and gets up to his top floor window because the water's now risen and the navy comes through. And he says, no, I'm waiting for a sign from God. Eventually, he's on the tip of his chimney and the Air Force comes and says, you know, come, you've got to come now. It's your last chance. No, I'm waiting for a sign from God. He dies. He goes to heaven and he says to God, where was your sign? And he said, I sent you the government, the army, the navy, and the Air Force. How many signs do you want? And, you know, it is a bit of that for me, is that actually you wake up and smell the coffee. And I do think we've been building to a momentum for this. If we just look at last year's climate action, you know, this year's devastation in the terms of the fires, I mean, visually. And
we have to kind of draw to a close here, unfortunately. Let me ask you kind of two funny points. You're a social entrepreneur, you know social entrepreneurs, people talk about kind of there's a vacuum of leadership around the place. Do you think social entrepreneurs and the like are right now, you're talking about this time, are they the people that need to step up and provide a lead here?
So, you know, I have a very mixed feeling to the word social entrepreneur, because I think it's, again, one of those schisms. And, you know, when I was working on the Social Stock Exchange, I remember speaking to somebody who was the Center for Business in South Africa, and she said to me, every entrepreneur is a social entrepreneur. You know, entrepreneurs look at opportunities, they fill gaps, they give jobs, they are all inherently social. And, you know, to the extent the business model in a for purpose, not for profit, it might be what distinguishes the social entrepreneur. But I do sometimes feel that we put too much emphasis on this social entrepreneur versus the other. And, you know, it's actually, if we're wanting to have an integrated role, we need to reflect that actually social entrepreneurs typically miss business models, or, you know, and so how did these things come together that they can actually benefit each other?
Okay, let me ask you another question. Let me put it another way to you then. Do we need new leaders emerging?
Absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, I think we have a complete lack of leadership, of values.
So, and where are they coming from, these new leaders? Where are they emerging from?
I think probably you're seeing them in, and you see, I wonder if they are entrepreneurial, or whether they aren't like Greta Thunberg's, or the, you know, there have been a number before her, young people with a vision of actually how it should be, and how it will last, and how they should live. You know, I can only hope that it's coming from the young people, you know.
Okay, it's fantastic. Right, so let me, I mean, it's just been really absolutely brilliant talking with you. Really fantastic. So one final question then. Are you, given this moment that we've just talked about, you've talked about, are you optimistic about the future?
Sometimes.
Let's hope there's more optimism than pessimism.
Well, I wake up every morning with hope and work to do. And if that's optimism, then yes.
That's optimism. That's optimism. That's my definition of optimism. I wake up every morning and go up and do stuff and try and make a contribution. And you certainly are making a contribution in the work that you have done in the past and that you are doing now. So more power to your elbow. And look, Tamsin, it's been really fabulous talking to you. I mean, sincerely, thank you very much for your time. And we'll meet up soon, maybe at a World Social Forum conference, but maybe it won't be in person. Maybe it will be one that's online. We'll certainly connect again at some point. So thank you very much.
I'll send you coffee for the next conversation. We can please drink coffee together.
Deal.
Great.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this conversation and have come away with some food for thought. We certainly did. We're taking a summer break for a few weeks, but we'll be back in September with some more thought-provoking conversations. As always, if you enjoy the podcast, we'd be so grateful if you could subscribe and leave a review. Thank you.